If you like what we discussed, you're going to love AboveTopSecret.com. I can tell you, AboveTopSecret.com's members and staff, they're top-notch. They're smart, current, articulate, and would you believe they're even polite? In fact, AboveTopSecret.com is world-renowned for its excellent management. And since they're one of the best boards on the internet with thousands of posts every day, you know they're doing it right. They've also got a hilarious podcast called ATS Mix, hosted by legendary Dave Rabbit and Johnny Anonymous, that covers all the hottest AboveTopSecret.com topics and conspiracy rumors. AboveTopSecret.com has dozens of forums, from UFOs and aliens to conspiracies, paranormal, and much, much more. So much more that I don't have time to name them all. Take it from me, AboveTopSecret.com is worth your time, because with more than 3 million posts on more than 250,000 topics, the truth is in there. So stop by AboveTopSecret.com and tell them I sent you. You can thank me tomorrow.
Now, continuing in our pursuit to deny ignorance, the following is a special edition of the ATS Mix. Now, here's Johnny Anonymous.
Well, we're very proud and honored to have with us on our show today a very special guest. Let me tell you a little bit about who this guest is. His name is Tom Carey, and Tom became interested in UFOs while in high school and rekindled that interest in 1986 when he became the MUFON State Section Director for the Southeastern Pennsylvania Group. Tom also became a special investigator for CUFOs, which is the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies, in 1992, and served on its board of directors from 1997 through 2001. He has a BS degree in business administration, a master's degree in anthropology, and has received a fellowship to pursue a PhD in anthropology at the University of Toronto. Since 1991, Tom's research has focused solely on the so-called Roswell incident, and because of its research, has appeared on numerous radio and TV programs, as well as being in several film documentaries. He's authored two books entitled The Roswell Dig Diaries and Witness to Roswell. His website is located at www.roswellinvestigator.com, and Roswell Investigator is all one word when you type that in. You may want to even go to that website as you're listening to this interview. It is with great pleasure to have with us today Tom Carey. Hi, Tom. How are you?
Hi, Johnny. Nice to be with you.
You know, I guess the first question I want to ask you is how on earth you got interested in UFOs?
Well, Johnny, it actually started when I was just a little kid, maybe 6 or 7 or 8 years old, somewhere in there. I was in the living room watching TV, and my older brother, who's now a professor emeritus at the University of Virginia, he read things like newspapers, which I didn't. And one day he said, "Hey, Tom, listen to this. The newspaper account told about these fiery discs which outran our latest jet fighters in the sky." And I thought that was just amazing, because I knew about jet fighters, you know, being a little kid playing war and all that sort of stuff.
Sure.
What could these fiery discs be? And that's what really kindled my interest in it.
Well, you know, there's probably going to be a small elite group of people that aren't going to have a clue about the Roswell incident. So could you tell our listeners, pretty much in a nutshell, what it was that was reported as to happening on that day in 1947?
This particular incident is considered the granddaddy of all UFO cases. It has been suggested that the whole phenomenon of UFOs, unidentified flying objects, will rise and fall on this one case. I don't agree with that, but because there are other good cases, but the best case, in my opinion anyway, is the Roswell case. It's got everything. It's held my interest as an active investigator for 16 years now. That's
wow.
Something to be said for that. And what happened was, back in July of 1947, a newspaper headline went around the world. Now, you have to understand that in June of 1947, the modern age of flying saucers or UFOs burst upon the American public. Just out of nowhere, people started seeing these strange things, mostly disc-shaped affairs, flying around the sky.
Right.
So 2 weeks later, this headline, and they, you know, nobody had a clue as to what they were, other than that they were out, you know, flying around faster than anything that we had. In early July, this is about 2 weeks after they first burst on the scene, this headline went around the world, RAAF, and that's not the Royal Air Force, that's the Roswell Army Airfield, located in Roswell, New Mexico, recovers flying saucer in Roswell region. So they're now, the Air Force is announcing that they recovered a flying disc, a flying saucer, as they were known back then. They weren't known as UFOs until a number of years later. So the world was startled. We got a flying saucer.
Sure.
And the first newspaper account was very sketchy, other than that they had recovered it on a ranch. The rancher brought pieces in, and the base intelligence officer from Roswell Field, Air Force bases were called fields back then,
sure,
that they recovered this, and it was being shipped to higher headquarters. And so that was the first day. The next day, you know, the world is now anticipating, oh my goodness, what can this be? This is, we got one, and let's get some more details. Well, the next day, the headline was, General Ramey empties Roswell saucer, or something like, Roswell saucer turns out to be just hot air. They took the story away. It went from an extraterrestrial spaceship to a weather balloon in one day. The story died at that point in the press. As far as the world knew, it was something that appeared to be momentous, and then it was something that appeared to be a silly mistake. Now, the problem with this was that everybody that was involved in this knew what it really was, but they were all sworn to secrecy or intimidated by death threats if they were civilians to keep quiet, or to treat it as a matter of national security, because the Cold War was just beginning then with the Soviet Union. So it was the patriotic duty never to speak of this. The case died for 30 years, and it wasn't until 1978 when the former Roswell base intelligence officer, Jesse Marcel, Major Jesse Marcel, who was a ham operator out of Houma, Louisiana, started talking about it over the ham network that he was on. And then ultimately it got to one of the UFO investigators named Stanton Friedman, who someone steered Stanton on to Jesse Marcel, and he interviewed him when he was giving a talk down in Louisiana. And that sort of got the civilian investigators on the case. I've been investigating the case since 1991, and I've hooked up with a fellow by the name of Don Schmidt, my co-author, in 1998 to continue a proactive investigation of the case. If you recall, 1997 was the 50th anniversary of the Roswell incident. And most investigators left the field at that point. Don and I wanted to continue not only just, you know, to investigate it, but to do a proactive investigation. By that I mean we're out there on a daily basis shaking the tree, trying to find new witnesses, physical evidence if we can, and we're not just sitting back waiting for a lead to come across our desk.
I'm sure.
So that's the case in a nutshell. I can tell your audience that we have over 600 witnesses to date who have given us information about the case, none of which is about a weather balloon or a high-altitude weather balloon or a top-secret balloon project, but all of them have given us information to an extraterrestrial explanation for the Roswell incident.
Well, now, I'm sure in that in your research and investigation with your partner, Don Schmidt, you must have gone to the property's owners, which I believe is the Brazil family. Had you had a chance to talk to any of the family members there, or perhaps to Mr. Brazel himself?
Oh, absolutely. Of course, William Mac Brazel, the first human to view the extraterrestrial wreckage, died in 1963, which was long before any of the civilian investigators knew about the case. We didn't know about the case until 1978. Brazel was gone in 1963. General Roger Ramey, who was the architect of the cover-up, died in 1963. Colonel William Blanchard, who was the base commander at Roswell Field, died in 1966 at age 50. He was the head of the commander of the 509th Bomb Group in Roswell,
sure.
which was the military unit that was involved in the recovery of the spacecraft and the bodies. And Blanchard was second in line to become Air Force Chief of Staff. He had 4 stars and was vice chief of staff of the Air Force when he passed away at his desk in the Pentagon in 66. So we never got to talk to him, but we did. Some of his children have talked. His wife has talked some. But most of the information we've gotten, Johnny, I have to tell you, has come from enlisted personnel, because we found that the higher the rank, the less likely they are to talk.
Right.
And if they were career military, whether enlisted or of officer grade, if they were a career military, they're less likely to talk. So it was the ones who have talked most, besides civilians, of course, have been the enlisted men who have not made a career out of the military.
Well, now I understand that. Is it Bill Brazel Jr., the son of the...
Yes, it's actually Bill Brazel. The junior doesn't apply, but his son was... Bill Brazel passed away 2 years ago.
Okay.
We've met with him many, many times.
Well, now, did he ever take you out to the spot where the alleged crash occurred?
Yes. In fact, that's how we located it, was that the Bill Brazel took us out there. And this would go back to, I'd say, 88, 89, somewhere in there when he took us out there. And that's why... We get these emails demanding to know the GPS coordinates of the site, you know, because various numbers are published from people who don't really know where the site is, but they claim they know where it is. And these coordinates get published, and the debunkers say, ah, see, the numbers are different. They really don't know where they're at. Well, I can tell your audience, we don't need GPS coordinates to get to the site, because we know exactly where it's at. It's been pointed out to us. We've been taken there, not only Bill Brazel, but others who had seen the wreckage and know the pasture, and they took us there. So we know exactly where there are three sites that we believe were involved in the so-called Roswell incident. The site we were just talking about, we call the Mac Brazel Foster Ranch debris field site. That's the site, that's the first site where Brazel found all of this wreckage strewn over a sheep pasture, perhaps a mile long by several hundred yards wide, just covered with small pieces of metallic debris. That's a debris field site, and if you go in an easterly, southeasterly direction from there, about 2 miles, 2.5 miles from that site, there's another site that Brazel knew about, but the investigators didn't know about it. The civilian investigators didn't know about it until the mid-90s, when we were taken there by the son of Loretta Proctor, who was Mac Brazel's closest neighbor. And it's called the D. Proctor site. Now, D. Proctor was a 7-year-old boy in 1947 who was with Mac Brazel when he found all of this stuff. He was also with Mac when Brazel found something else about 2.5 miles east-southeast of the debris field. And what he found were several small bodies with large heads that he just called unfortunate little creatures. That's what he referred to them as. They didn't refer to them as aliens or things like that. They either referred to them as little people or creatures, something like that. We were taken to that site in the mid-90s by D. Proctor, who died 2 years ago. And that would be site number two. The third site we only found 2 years ago, it's in the straight line east-southeast from the debris field, is where the remainder of the ship, we believe the ship was struck by lightning. That's our best guess, is that it was struck by lightning and the outer shell exploded over the Mac Brazel pasture and continued on. And during the explosion, some of the occupants were blown out and came down at that second site that I just told you about.
Okay.
The rest of them were in an inner cabin or an escape pod of some sort that withstood the initial explosion and continued on another 30 miles or so, maybe a little less, and came to rest at a spot 40 miles due north of Roswell and maybe 5 miles west off of Highway 285. We only found that site 2 years ago.
But it does follow the same linear line.
Yes, exactly. Hmm. Yes, yes.
Interesting.
So those are the three sites. Now, back in 1980, when the first book about Roswell was written, called The Roswell Incident, and it's from the title of that book by William Moore and Charles Berlitz, that most people refer to this event as the Roswell Incident. It comes from the title of the book. Back when that book was written, they didn't know about Site 2 or 3 that I just told you about.
Okay.
What they had was a story that was floating around that it involved a soil conservation engineer named Barney Barnett, who had told his family about finding a spaceship that had crashed on the plains of San Augustine. Now, this is west of Socorro, New Mexico, maybe 150 miles due west of the Brazel Ranch. And so you would have to think, well, geez, this thing exploded, then took a hard right turn and went due west to Socorro and landed or crashed. And there were several bodies reported by Barney Barnett. Now, Barnett died in 1969, so none of us got to talk to him. We got the story from friends and family members, but the story is lacking in further corroboration and also a year in which it occurred. So that's the only body story that they had involving a spaceship, allegedly for this time period. So they used that in the book to state that that was where the final impact site was. And we have investigated that. In fact, we're still investigating this particular Barney Barnett story, because everybody that ever had anything to say about him said that he was a straight arrow, he would never lie. And so for that reason, we continue to investigate the Barney Barnett story to try to pin it down to a year, if indeed it did occur.
In your research here and investigation, I'm curious, now that we know that there are three sites, were any of the debris or material that was at any one of these sites ever excavated by the family members and taken elsewhere?
That's a good question. The whenever there's a crash, whether it be an airplane or in this case an extraterrestrial craft out there in the desert, we know from talking to the civilians are always the first ones to get there.
Sure.
New Mexico was a hotbed of activity back in the 40s, tests of rockets, and the first A-bomb was even detonated in New Mexico.
Right.
And weather balloons going up and down all the time. But we know from talking to them that the civilians are always the first ones to get there. And there's no doubt in our mind that civilians pocketed pieces of the ship. And Don and I are actively trying to locate one of these civilians. We do have a few names that have been given to us of civilians who have had pieces allegedly in the family now for 60 years. But we are working some leads along those lines. And to answer your question, yes, we do have several accounts of civilians having pieces of the ship, even an account of a civilian taking pictures, photographs of the crash site, all before the military got there.
Really?
And I can tell you, in interviewing the Corona ranchers, that the military, they were so afraid, so concerned that the ranchers had pieces of the ship, that they literally went to these ranches and tore their homes upside down, inside out, looking for pieces.
You're kidding.
That they might have taken and hidden. We know for a fact that the Brazel Ranch, they came out there, they searched everything. They took up the floorboards of the ranch house.
Oh, my.
They cut open meal bags. Now, these are bags of meal that they would feed the cattle, these were cattle ranches.
Sure.
They cut open the meal bags and emptied them, checking to see if maybe they had put a piece in there. They went down into the cellars. They just turned these places upside down, and they threatened all of these people with their lives if they ever said anything. Here we are 60 years later. We do have a few names of people allegedly have a piece. In fact, I've gotten two new names within the last 2 weeks.
That answers my next question, because if I recall correctly, the International UFO Museum and Research Center supposedly has offered $1 million for the first scientifically verified piece of physical debris from the Roswell crash. And I was going to ask you if anybody has come forward, and obviously probably not.
When we ever get a lead on concerning physical evidence, that lead always goes to the head of the line.
I'm sure.
If you know what I mean. But
sure.
As far as the museum is concerned, the only thing they received was and it's now hanging up in the museum down there, turned out to be a hoax. It was a piece of silvery goldish metal that didn't really resemble anything.
Yeah.
And this was maybe 10, 12 years ago. And after it was checked out, and it does take some doing to check these things out, it turned out to be from a jeweler in Utah, and it was a piece of Japanese jewelry that had been apparently misshapen and pounded into various shapes with a hammer, so you didn't know what it was, and it turned out to be a hoax. But they have it hanging up in the museum as we speak as to what, you know, some of the things that we go through to check things out.
I was just going to say that some of the rumors that obviously has been passed around throughout the community is that there is some form of metal that they're calling it, I believe, memory metal, which seems to retain
yes.
shape.
That's Don and I call the memory metal what you've just mentioned. To us, it's the Holy Grail of Roswell. And I
right.
say that because if you have a piece of this memory metal, you do not have to send it out to have it analyzed. Ultimately, it would be sent out to be analyzed, but you can tell right away that this is indeed something truly extraordinary. It's been described to us by a number of still living witnesses who have held it in their hands that it's very thin, like, now I don't smoke, but in packs of cigarettes, there's at least they used to put the little tin foil in there, very, very thin,
okay.
in packs of cigarettes to keep them fresh, I guess.
Right.
Well, it's metal that's that thin, but is very smooth. I mean, it's smooth, doesn't have any creases or nicks or anything like that, but it's part of some of the stuff that was found on the Foster Ranch that you can wad it up into your hand. Just take a piece of it, wad it up, and it feels like you've got nothing in your hand. And then you hold it over a flat surface, and before it hits the surface, it just flattens right out without a crease back to its original shape. Now, we don't have anything like that will behave like that,
right.
that is that you can't scratch. You can take a knife or an acetylene torch. You can't deform it in any way with any, you know, diamond drill. You can't scratch it. You can't do anything like that to it. We don't have anything like that. They certainly didn't have in 1947. We still don't have today. That's what we call the Holy Grail, because you can see in an instant that here we have a piece of something that we still do not have.
There seems to be rumors also that at the time of the military being there gleaning the ground, that they also came across, obviously, the same idea that this was some metal that was fairly extraordinary.
Well, at first, you know, the military mind works in very narrow, well, almost tunnel vision sometimes. they have their mission, and that's what they're always thinking about, their mission. The Air Force mission is to control the skies,
right.
okay? So the first thought back in 1947 was that it must be Russian. So they sent the two top intelligence people out to the site to see what was there. They followed the rancher out, and Jesse Marcel later said that he immediately came to the conclusion that it was extraterrestrial. But of course, the military back at the base, meanwhile back at the base, they're thinking this has got to be something Russian.
Right.
Well, at some point they realized that it wasn't Russian. And then the modus operandi became how to keep it from the Russians. They didn't want the Russians to know that they had technology available to us that they didn't have. So that was the motive behind covering this thing up initially.
Right.
Also, part of the cover-up was certainly the memory of the 1938 War of the Worlds radio show.
Sure.
starring Orson Welles that panicked the East Coast of the United States, even though it was announced that it was a fictionalized portrayal. It was a portrayal of H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds. So that's why it was covered up back then. But the thing was, they first thought it was Russian, and then they realized that it wasn't. And then it became, how do we exploit this, and how do we keep it secret? And they kept it secret by a number of methods, depending upon the person they were trying to silence, whether it was a military person, whether it was a member of the press who already had the story, or whether it was a civilian that they had no real control over. So that was the problem confronting them in a short order there.
Right. You made a mention there that Jesse Marcel didn't go with the stance that it was Russian, that it was extraterrestrial. And this also may have been one of the first times that we know of that there was purported to be some occupants actually found. So tell us a little bit about what these little people were that they found.
Well, I'm thinking hard now if there were any stories of occupants, and I think the Roswell case might in fact be the first one, at least the one I can think of right now, that involved occupants.
Right.
Now, the stories that hit the press regarding the Roswell incident back in 47, there was no mention of occupants.
Right.
It was just the mention of a recovery of a flying saucer or flying disc. But there was no mention of bodies, even though they knew about bodies. So they had to kill that story, and they did. But it wasn't until years later that when the civilian investigators started looking into the case, and I mentioned that the Barney Barnett story was actually the first story of occupants from an extraterrestrial craft.
Sure.
The thing was, the Roswell incident book came out in 1980. There were stories before that published involving occupants, but those cases themselves occurred later. So the 47 incident was the first real case involving occupants that I can think of right now. But what happened was, of the three sites that I mentioned to you earlier,
right,
two of them were body sites. The original debris field site that Mac Brazel found on the morning of July the 4th, the ship exploded late in the evening of July the 3rd, 1947. The next day he went out to check his cattle and the fence because it was a severe storm the night before, where he thought he heard a strange muffled explosion between the thunderclaps. So he went out the next day with Dee Proctor, neighbor boy,
right,
when they found the wreckage. Well, that first site didn't have any bodies. It was the second site, the Dee Proctor site, that he found maybe a day or two later that he encountered bodies. We didn't know that Brazel had actually found bodies until in 1998. We interviewed again for maybe the fourth or fifth time the radio announcer from radio station KGFL in Roswell. When his name was Frank Joyce, who's still alive, by the way. Frank Joyce had just retired from KOB in Albuquerque, radio station KOB, and he told us that he had one more piece to the story that he had never related to anybody over the years, and it involved the bodies. And he told us that when Mac Brazel first came into town and was interviewed by Joyce, just by chance, it was by chance that Joyce got to interview him, that Brazel told him about the other site. And he said, there's another site, and Frank Joyce says, well, where is it? He says, well, it's someplace else. It was the 2.5 mile site, 2.5 miles from the refield. He said, where I found little creatures, the smell was terrible. And well, Frank Joyce says, well, you know, the Air Force is, you know, they put monkeys and into rocket ships, and you know, they test them out, and Brazel just starts screaming. They weren't monkeys, and they weren't human. And he slammed down the phone. When we were told that story, we started interviewing people, including Brazel family members, if Brazel ever mentioned the bodies, and they said yes.
Huh.
And we talked to his granddaughter, Fawn Fritz, and she said she overheard her grandfather talking to her father about finding the bodies. And she said, what did they look like, Granddad? What did they look like? And he said, nothing you'd ever want to see.
Hmm.
There were nothing you would ever want to see. The poor, unfortunate little creatures met their death. So Brazel never described them to us through his family, but we've interviewed a number of other witnesses that talked about the bodies, especially at the third site, what we call the impact site, 40 miles north, due north of town, where the inner cabin of the ship or the escape pod, if that's what it was, came to rest. And we got testimony on tape from military people and civilians who saw those alien creatures at that site. There were perhaps four of them all together, and one, according to everybody, there was one that was alive. And the description of them is all the same, 3.5 to 4 feet tall, grayish-green, grayish-blue, grayish-pink skin, depending upon the light, whether it was sunlight or dark or what, grayish in color, slightly slanted eyes set far apart, no nose, just two little holes in the front of the face where the nostrils would be, and no ears, just two little holes in the side of the head where the ears would be. Little slit, maybe an inch long for a mouth. And the overriding feature is always the large head, the enlarged head, shaped like an inverted pear. You just take a pear or an egg, turn it upside down to where the pointed part is at the bottom, and you got the shape of the head. Maybe 40 pounds, maybe they weighed maybe 40 pounds, long arms and four digits, wearing a silvery, grayish, silvery type of uniform, no markings on it, but skin tight. And one was alive. So the descriptions are consistent.
And I'm pretty sure probably that the government got, besides all the bodies, probably still had the one that was alive. Have you ever heard any rumors of how long living one might have lived?
We've heard different stories about when it might have met its demise. We've heard stories that it lived until 1952 at Wright Field.
Right.
In Dayton, Ohio. We've heard stories that it might have expired soon thereafter it was taken, after it was taken into, let's say, into custody, which is probably not a good way to describe it. And we've heard that from one fellow through his son that the father had visited Wright Field with a Air Force War College class. In late July of 1947, they were flown to Wright Field to look at the wreckage, and they were shown the one that was alive. The father told the son that they all got to view the one that was alive, and he described it as squiggly-looking.
Squiggly.
And squiggly. And that was his description. But he also said that his understanding was that it died soon thereafter, when they were doing some experiment on it. So we've got these different stories of when it might have expired, and quite frankly, we don't know.
Right. There seems to also be some reports that seem to corroborate that there were indeed some bodies that were brought to somewhere because of some small coffins that were ordered. Could you tell us about that?
Yes. There was a funeral home in Roswell. It's still there, by the way. The original funeral home, Ballard Funeral Home, had the contract with the base, the Roswell Field, for mortuary services. It also had the contracts for ambulance services at the same time. So, which meant that if you were injured and you needed an ambulance to take you back to the field, you were driven in a hearse. And I don't know if that's a good thing. It doesn't sound like a good thing to me. But so the embalmer at Ballard Funeral Home, his name is Glenn Dennis. He's still alive. Started receiving these phone calls from the base from an officer who described himself as the mortuary officer, wanting to know if they had any child's caskets on hand. And Glenn Dennis told them that he'd make a quick check and get back to him. Well, he made a quick check, and they had one on hand, And Dennis told the officer that he could have as many as they wanted delivered the next morning. And the officer said, well, that's all right. We'll just hold off on that for now. It's a question, because we've heard both sides, whether the extra caskets were in fact ever delivered or not. We don't think they were, because what happened was the very next day there was a flight. Now this would be the next day would be July the 9th, 1947. There was a flight of a B-29 from Roswell Field to Fort Worth, which later became Carswell Air Force Base, but back then it was known as Fort Worth Army Airfield. Now Fort Worth housed the command structure of the 8th Air Force, to which the 509th Bomb Group in Roswell was attached. So the next higher headquarters was in Fort Worth, and that was where the commander of the 8th Air Force, General Roger M. Ramey, was headquartered. Most of the stuff that wound up in Dayton, Ohio, went through Fort Worth, including the bodies. Well, there were two body flights, actually. One went straight from Roswell to Dayton, Ohio, by way of Andrews Air Force Base in Washington, D.C., so the higher-ups could get a look at the bodies. But the second set of bodies went out on July the 9th. Now, these are the bodies that Glenn Dennis was involved with, where they started calling Glenn Dennis for these caskets.
Right.
On this flight, because we interviewed all of the enlisted men on the flight, this July 9 flight of, we call it the Flight of the Straight Flush, was the name of the B-29, was a large wooden crate, perhaps 4 feet wide, 4 feet high, and 16 feet long, just long enough to maybe house three or four of these little fellas end to end,
right,
head to foot. And we've interviewed as many as of the people on that crew as we could that were still alive. The officers wouldn't talk to us, but the enlistees did. And that's the flight where they landed, that they took off from Roswell and landed in Fort Worth an hour later. And one of the crew said, "Hey, I know that guy." Now, this is one of the officers on the flight exclaimed when the plane touched down in Fort Worth that he recognized one of the officers waiting in the greeting party for the B-29 as an undertaker, as an officer who was an undertaker in civilian life, and in the Air Force he was a mortuary officer. Of course, the enlisted men weren't told anything. They just heard this voice over the intercom saying, "Hey, I know that guy. He's a undertaker." By this time, the crew had heard all the stories about the crash flying saucer, and they were starting to put two and two together, because this was the strangest flight they'd ever been on, with this big wooden crate. All of the officers get off the plane. The enlisted men aren't allowed off the plane, so the officers go into the building there off the tarmac, and the crate is unloaded. And we've talked to people who are actually security guards guarding that crate. Now, this flight was strange in that the B-29 is constructed to cruise at 30,000 feet.
Right.
Well, this flight, they flew at only 8,000 feet. And the reason they flew so low was because there was a security detail inside the bomb bay guarding the wooden crate with loaded carbines inside the bomb bay during the flight. Now,
during
you figure that one out.
Wow.
Yes. That's why they had to fly at 8,000 feet, because they had, you know, because they
didn't have to,
they'd pass out. Yeah. So one of the enlisted men that I talked to, he said he also recognized one of the security guards as a physician from the Roswell base dressed up as an MP. He recognized him because he had treated him the week before for something. And here he was dressed up in costume as an MP holding a carbine on this flight as a security officer. So the plane lands, the crate is unloaded, the officers go into the building there, and after a few minutes, the crew is given lunch, et cetera, et cetera. They come back out, they get back on the plane, and then they take off. And just as they take off, the same fellow who cried out, "Hey, I know that guy," he let loose again. He said, "Boys, We just made the history books. And this was when the flight had just taken off. An hour later, they land back in Roswell, and they're debriefed, and it was emphasized to them that there was nothing extraordinary about this flight. This was just a normal flight, nothing extraordinary about it, and never mention it. It basically didn't take place. And like I said, we interviewed the crew, and they all believe that today, they believe that they flew the bodies.
Well, you know, you were talking about interviewing some of the crew members that may have information about what happened in those couple of days is getting far and thin because of their age. I'm just curious, has there been anybody that you have come across that possibly is not alive today, but perhaps somebody that made like a deathbed confession to their family members or to you or to Don that you know about?
Quite a few.
Really?
Quite a few, yes. We've got a number of deathbed confessions, and in our next book, we're going to include more. In our current book, we have a number of new deathbed confessions. The one that's one of the most striking to me is the fellow, his name was James Rowlett. He was from the 603rd Air Engineering Squadron. He passed away in the 1970s, and he was a 26-year man in the Air Force. And his was literally a deathbed confession. He was actually on the gurney in the hospital to be wheeled in for a life-saving operation. His daughter, who, you know, knew he had been in the Air Force, but, you know, stationed at Roswell, but her father never had said anything, and she didn't ask, so he waves her over. Now, you know that, you know, when you're about to go into surgery, I know when I had my tonsils out, you know, they give you a little something to relax you, right?
Sure.
It's sometimes known as truth serum. But he waves his daughter over, and now he's ready to go in for this, you know, this life or death operation. He waves her to come over to the gurney, and they're outside the operating room. He says, "I got to tell you, I was at Roswell when a UFO crashed. It really happened. I was involved. I helped clean up the wreckage, and I saw three bodies. And
wow.
Then I also saw one that was alive." Now he's on his deathbed. You can't get any
right.
more than that. He's ready to be wheeled in.
Right.
Well, fortunately, he didn't die in operation, but he did die shortly thereafter. So that is a literal deathbed confession, and she relayed that story to us, that in his last, what he thought might be his last moment, his thoughts were that he had to tell his daughter about Roswell, and he said he's sorry he never mentioned it to her, but that he was told never to talk about it or else, and they never said what the or else was, but you could imagine, they left it to your imagination.
I'm sure. Now, you say that this, along with others, are going to be coming out in a new book, I guess, that you're working on. What's going to be the name of the book?
Well, the name of the book is going to be Of Unknown Origin, The Roswell UFO Crash. It's going to be a continuation where we see in our current book, if I could give it a little plug for your
sure.
audience. We currently have a book out. It came out in June called Witness to Roswell, Unmasking the 60-Year Cover-Up. You can get it at your local bookstore, Barnes & Noble, Borders, or any other bookstore, or on Amazon. What we have done in this book is that we put out a lot of new material to demonstrate to the reading audience that, A, there is somebody still working on the Roswell case. Now, Don Schmidt and I are, like I said, we're the only currently proactive, and we've been proactive since 1998, investigators on this case. That means that we're out there every day shaking the tree, not just waiting for stuff to come to us. We also wanted to demonstrate some of the new material that we've been getting. I have to tell you, it's much more than we anticipated. The World War II generation, the greatest generation, is passing from the scene
right.
at the rate of about 1,200 to 1,500 per day. And it's our mandate to get as many of the witnesses that were there as we can, because when they're gone, their stories are gone forever.
Now, if somebody were to have some information that was still alive and by chance happened to hear this interview, would they be able to go to your website at www.roswellinvestigator.com and be able to contact you?
Yes, but let me give you the contact numbers since we're on the air.
Sure.
You can reach me direct dial at my home office here at area code 267-722-8121. That's 267-722-8121. And you can also email me directly at tcarey, that's T-C-A-R-E-Y, followed by the numerals 1947 at AOL.com. That's tcarey1947 at AOL.com. Those two contact numbers will get you right to me.
Listen, Tom, I can't tell you or thank you enough for coming on the ATS Mix and letting us interview you. And once again, we want to let our listeners and members know that if you want to get any more information about Tom and his partner, Don Schmidt, and what they are doing currently, you can do that by going to their website at www.RoswellInvestigator.com. Roswell Investigator, all being one word. Tom, thank you again for joining us, and I wish you much success in your endeavors.
Hey, Johnny, it's been great. It's been my pleasure, and you know your stuff, and you asked all the right questions.
Oh, good. Perhaps if you come up with some new information, you'll come back and chat with us?
I sure will.
That'll be great.
Be happy to.
On behalf of the ATS Mix, thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.
This is Bob. He's a hard-working 30-something male that is well-liked at the office. But Bob is hiding a secret affliction that he's hidden all his life. You see, Bob suffers from what has just been recently diagnosed as politicus uneducatus. Fortunately for Bob and millions of sufferers like him, there is help available for the politically uninformed. And it's available free 24 hours a day to anyone connected to the internet. All Bob has to do is type in www.abovepolitics.com and his disease soon will disappear completely. With Above Politics, Bob can now be informed in what's happening not only with the U.S., but also in the worldwide politics arena. It doesn't matter if it's liberal, conservative, socialized, moderate, or other, Bob can't help but become better educated. He'll soon be up to speed on important issues on topics like the economy, military and security action, energy and science, religious and spiritual influences. And when it comes to finding out the latest on the political player's motivation and sentiments, Bob now will know the difference from the left and the right and everything in between. If you cringe at political discussions around the water cooler like Bob does, grab a pen and paper now and write this web address down. www.abovepolitics.com. It will change your life forever.
ATS Mix from AboveTopSecret.com is over.
You've been listening to the ATS Mix with Dave Rabbit and Johnny Anonymous. If you have a comment, suggestion, an opposing view, or would like to participate in a future show of ATS Mix, please contact Dave or Johnny at www.abovetopsecret.com. The views expressed on ATS Mix do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of the Above Network, LLC, or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening. You may now reattach your tinfoil hat.